He has chosen to speak on the subject of winds. Winds. Brother Ray.
Our custom is to bring to the conventions our greetings of the Jersey City Ecclesia. And they commissioned me to give you their special message by use of 1 Corinthians 3:21 and 23. Therefore let no man glory in men, for all things are yours, and ye are Christ's, and Christ is God's. Our remarks for the afternoon was suggested and requested by members of the local ecclesia, reminding us that many years ago we did give a discourse on this subject, and they asked that we kind of repeat it. And I trust that working on the principle that repetition deepens impression, that those of you who may have heard it in the past will just bear with us, and we trust we'll find some help in this presentation. Our meditation upon winds is primarily based upon its usage in Bible symbolism, because we know that God communicates with us and in our limitations by use of similes, metaphors, and pictures, in types and in shadows, to try to convey to our finite, limited, materially bound mentalities the eternal and the infinite spiritual truths and realities. And how do we convey such vast, infinite thoughts into the flesh and blood and the mere nervous tissue of the human frame? And the easiest and apparently the most effective means of so doing is by using these pictures of the familiar experiences that we enjoy in this life, and drawing from them lessons that will pertain to things spiritual. And therefore, wheat and tares, captains, soldiers, sheep and shepherds, vine and branches, potter and vessels, are all used in an attempt to help us to understand some of the deeper mysteries of God. And hence, earthquakes and thunderings and lightnings and whirlwinds are similarly used. Therefore, we thought we would just analyze the use of winds in this Bible illustration, that God is conveying to us concepts which otherwise might be very vague and incapable of perception. Of course, when we think of winds, we must think of the phenomena that we see around here on Earth, which meteorology and geophysics explains to us as a phenomena of natural law. There are really four causes for winds. One is the atmosphere, this canopy of gaseous molecules, which we call our atmosphere, roughly 100 miles thick, which is an envelope in boundless space, containing in it the necessary gases which enables us to sustain life. Oh, the oxygen, the hydrogen, and the nitrogen, and some of the rarer gases are all kept within this little envelope, which makes life on our planet so unique and different from anywhere else in the universe. And in this envelope, it is being held to the surface of the Earth by the force of gravity. And in that gravitational force, all of the molecules of the air have their flowing and their activities in what we call winds. And the basics of winds are simply that as these molecules go over the surface of the Earth, it collects more moisture from the seas, 16 times as much as it would over the land mass. And therefore, as the molecules pick up more moisture and travel in the direction of the rotation of the Earth from the sea mass to the land mass, there is a precipitation and a dropping of moisture, which we call rain. and that this flow from a high pressure to a low pressure produces this current of winds. And when this current is in optimum condition, the force of winds becomes so horrifying and terrifying. Witness this very moment in Central America, the horrible hurricane of Joan. And just a month ago, the island of Jamaica was devastated by Gilbert's ferocious devastation. We get an idea as to the power and force of winds and how mankind is helpless in its presence. And all man can hope to do is to merely flee for safety and allow the fury of the elements to take their toll. Little wonder then that the Master used such a vast, mighty phenomenon of nature to convey some truths which are so eternal and which are so broad-sweeping in their instruction and in their teaching. And we find then that the analogy of winds to earth is so wonderfully helpful to us. And in the absence of them, we would have a problem in understanding some of the finer points that God intends for us to believe and to know about in his divine plan of the ages. Oh, I think one of the ones, of course, which comes to our minds immediately is that beautiful dialogue between the Master and this wise man of the Jews, Nicodemus. You remember how in that nighttime dialogue with Nicodemus, how he did approach the Master in a very humble, contrite way. He said, "We know that thou art a teacher come from God, for no man can do these miracles that thou doest except God be with him." And then came this beautiful dialogue in which the Master was trying to convey to the natural-mindedness of this leader and this learned man what it means to be begotten or to know or to be accepted by God through his Spirit. And as the dialogue and Nicodemus was getting on very concrete levels and terms, the Master then comes down to his level and says that now unless you can be begotten again, you cannot really know, enter into the kingdom of God. And then Nicodemus in his naturalness asks, "Well, how can I then enter into my mother's womb and be born?" And then the Master says, "Marvel not when I said unto you, you must be," our common version says, "born again," but we shall see that that is really a mistranslation. "The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth. So is every one that is born of the Spirit." If we did not understand winds, their method of operating, what they consist of, we also would be prone to that error of seeing this process of begettal in terms of the nominal approach or view of being born. Because as they conceive of this dialogue, they see born as written here, not realizing that the term genal, which was used here, indicates the process of bringing forth. And whether or not it is in the masculine or feminine gender in this context, determining whether what is referred to is the one that originates that life, the life giver, the masculine, or that which is it forth, which produces it to full fruition at birth, the feminine gender, they strew it in their understanding to be in the feminine, to be born again, rather than in the masculine use of that term to be begotten. And therefore, in the eighth verse, we have a clear definition of what the Master meant. It was not merely that at that point in which you are begotten that you will be like the wind, but anyone that is born of the Spirit will be like the wind, and as the wind, we can observe, is invisible, but yet its power and its force and its presence is very well known by the effects which it produces. And therefore, we have this beautiful truth as we understand then this process of sanctification that comes into a new creature's life, that as one is begotten, a new creature is now developed. For if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Behold, all things have passed away and all things become new. And therefore, it is now the beginning of this new life. This new creature now is begotten. And then during the period of spiritual gestation, which we call sanctification, it ultimately will come to a point in which it is to be developed. And then born. And then as it is born of the Spirit, one is then brought into the very likeness of God, and one is then truly born on the divine plane, going as the wind, having a spiritual body and a spiritual nature. But we see that in this process of development, though, between the begettal and the birth, there can be some mishap. There can be, for example, a failure to develop whatever. And there is then a stillbirth. There is a spontaneous abortion. There is then no fruition of life. And thus we see that there will be some who will be begotten of God's Spirit, but yet because of their lack of faithfulness and because of their denial of that blood which bought them, and because they turn their backs upon their work of sacrifice, they will not emerge into any birth, but rather they will be into perdition. They will be those whom we call those of the second death class, who will be come forth stillbirth, without any life, who will not be fit then for the kingdom. And then there are those who do not go on to full term, those who do not come to the normal process of birth. There are some who have to be, as it were, taken from the womb of the mother because of some defect somewhere in the uterine process. And therefore it is necessary for the surgeon to make his Caesar section and then take the child from the uterus and to take the child by, as it were, this man of opportunity to bring it forth to life. And thus it will be with those whom we style of the great company class. There will be those who will not be developed to full term, who will allow the fear of death to keep them from carrying out fully their sacrifice, and it will be necessary for God, as it were, through surgical means, through the man of fit opportunity, to give them the experiences and the trials and the tribulations which they will need in order to bring them to a point of dedication and full consecration. And as they then see the course of life and the purpose of God in their lives, they will then complete the work, and they will come forth not to the prize of the high calling, but rather being on the throne, they will be, as pictured by the Revelator, before the throne, waving their palms of victory, but yet not of the more than overcomers. And then, of course, we have the full term. Ones who were begotten, and then the whole process of gestation went forth to its completion, and that miracle of miracles. And when we consider the birth of a child, one of the greatest miracles so commonplace in our experience, but when one thinks of the billions of cells in which something could go wrong with that development, and then when it comes to the fullness of development, the birth, and oh, the 144,000 who will so be, how of all of Adam's creation, out of every one nation, kindred, and tribe, this select company, who will be called, chosen, and faithful, and who will then have proven themselves worthy for this glorious prize to be with the Lamb in that glorious spiritual kingdom. And so, if we did not understand Jesus' words to Nicodemus about one who is born on the Spirit would come as the winds, we would not know the beauties of this teaching to understand the development of the church that is implicit in this concept of begettal and of birth. And then, too, again, we see that winds is used in another context, as it pertains to the world of mankind and God's purposes relevant to them. You know that in the scriptures, and in the book of Daniel in particular, how we have such beautiful understanding of the times in which we live because of the prophecies that he has given. And you remember the one of the key prophecies, and oh, how when I first read the first volume, how when I read that second chapter of the book of Daniel, and I saw that image, Nebuchadnezzar's image, and how Daniel's interpretation of it, the head of gold and the shoulders of silver and the belly and thigh of brass and then the iron with the legs and then the clay interwoven with the iron of the toes. And when that wise and faithful servant pointed out, oh, this is God's point of view. This is God's view of the times of the Gentiles, of the kingdoms of this world, and here is Babylon, Medo-Persia, then Greece, and then Rome, and then the pagan and papal system. Oh, how I just rejoiced our heart. And then we turned to the seventh chapter of the book of Daniel and saw the same panorama, but only from another perspective. Not from man's perspective of seeing this image in its beauty and the fine metals, precious metals. Now we see it from the beauty, from the standpoint of God. And rather than seeing these kingdoms as a thing of beauty or a thing of a work of art, rather we see these kingdoms as ferocious beasts. And in God's sight, these are so obnoxious and so terrifying and so carnivorous. And in the fourth verse, through the seventh verses, we see how Daniel sees a lion, then a bear, then a leopard, and then this beast, which he did not name. Could not call it more than just that. It was such a horrifying creature. And then when he saw this vision in the second verse, he says, Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens drove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. And there we get the thought that out then of all the restless masses of mankind, there comes then these four universal empires, ferocious and horrible in their being and in their administration. But it comes out of the sea when the winds of the heavens drove upon the great sea. The wind of God's providence then, interacting with the affairs of men, presents then these four universal governments in which man seeks to govern himself. And the Lord allows now, taking the kingdom from Israel and permitting the Gentiles to then work out their own destinies. And we know the results of it, how clearly the scriptures and how Daniel has so beautifully pinpointed for our admonition. And thank God that we have our eyes of understanding open, the provision of prophecy with our insights enables us to pinpoint where we are on the stream of time. And again, we see the same picture in Revelation 7, 1-4, those four angels holding back these winds, waiting until you and I are finishing our work of sanctification, our work of spiritual gestation, until we get to the point of readiness for our coming forth from the matrix of our covenant relationship with God. And then when the church is sealed in their foreheads and their work is done, then the whirlwinds of the present world will be released by those angels. But we note that in these pictures of the winds upon the earth, that there are directional winds, that there's an east wind, a north wind, a west wind, and a south wind. And we would suggest, dear friends, that again, this concept of winds enables us to see some beautiful instructions and lessons as contained in these wind directions. For one thing, there is an east wind. And I would submit, dear friends, that this east wind would picture for us the winds of curse and of death, sin and death that entered into the human experience. We know that whenever east winds is mentioned in the Bible, it is accompanied by destruction. It is then resulting in the downfall of someone. In the 41st chapter of Genesis, in the 6th verse, we have our first encounter with the use of east winds. Remember that when Pharaoh had that dream, and he slept, and this 5th verse says, he slept and dreamed a second time, and behold, 7 ears of corn came up upon one stalk, rank and good. And behold, 7 thin ears, and blasted with the east wind, sprung up after them. And the 7 thin ears devoured the 7 rank and full ears. And Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. It was the east wind that devoured the healthy and the fruitful corn stalks. It was the east wind then that pictures the devastation that God has in bringing about this 10th plague, this 9th plague rather, that would be able to bring Israel's salvation and deliverance. And then too we read of the east wind in Jonah 4:8, where when Jonah was escaping from the winds and the terrible parching sun, there was the gourd that was raised, and the gourd was then withering, and the east wind blew on Jonah with such forcefulness that the parching winds from the Arabian desert just seemed to take his life from him, and he would seem to almost expire because of the horrible devastation of that wind. And so we would suggest that sin and death are pictured by the east wind. But then there is the Exodus 10 would picture the west wind, in which the winds of the east are neutralized by the west wind. And here we find in the 9th plague upon Egypt, the Lord turned a mighty strong west wind, which took away the locusts and cast them into the Red Sea. There remained not one locust in all the coasts of Egypt. The locusts were brought by the east wind, and they were reduced, or they were erased, by the action of the west wind. And so the west wind would be picturing the ransom, in which the effects of sin and death would be then nullified, and man would be redeemed and ransomed from sin and death. This same thought is, I believe, conveyed to us in the book of Hosea, and in the 13th verse, in which humankind is pictured by Israel, and Ephraim in particular. In the 13th chapter of Hosea, again, we find that the 4 universal empires are referred to in the 7th verse, wherein Hosea explains that Israel was given a kingdom, and because of their idolatry, it was taken from them, and therefore, in the 7th verse it reads, I will be unto them as a lion, as a leopard, by the way I will observe them, and I will meet them as a bear that is bereaved of her whelps, and I will rend the call of their heart, and there will I devour them like a lion, the wild beast shall tear them. Saying that now that you have rejected me, I now am sending unto you the lion, the leopard, the bear, and the wild beast. And so we have, as it were, a telescoping of this same times of the Gentiles. But then it goes on in the 11th verse and speaks of the iniquity of Ephraim in the 12th verse is bound up and his sin is hidden. And I would suggest that here the prophet is now transferring, as it were, the focus of God's attention to the world of mankind, and uses Ephraim as a picture of Adam and his posterity. Ephraim was fruitful, And certainly it was told to Adam to be fruitful, to multiply, and to fill the earth. But notice what it says in regards to Ephraim. His iniquity is bound up and his sin is hidden. The thought of bound up is it's tied up, as though it were preserved in a bag, that it is completely contained in itself, that the iniquity is there and it is unremoved, and that the thought of hid is stored away, according to Rotherham, as though the iniquity of mankind and of Ephraim are to be there until the Lord takes them away. And it says, the sorrows of a travailing woman shall come upon him. He is an unwise son, for he should not stay long in the place of the breaking forth of children. Oh, how aptly it describes the condition of mankind, and of Adam in particular. Can you imagine the sorrows of a travailing woman coming upon him? I can't think of any more tragic experience than for Adam to have been walking in the garden or in the wilderness, and then as he walked to suddenly stumble in the field across the body of his dear son Abel. Can you imagine the travail that must have struck him? How he must have recognized, oh, the exceeding sinfulness of what I have done. How that one transgression has now so multiplied that now here, my dear one from the loins of my own body is now in death. Oh, indeed, he must have recognized that what an unwise son he was. And he shall not stay long in the place of the breaking forth of children. He will no longer stay here on earth as was promised him eternally if he would obey God. But he would shortly, within the span of that 1,000 years, 930 years, he would leave the place of the breaking forth of children. And in the 15th verse, though he be fruitful among his brethren, an east wind shall come. The wind of the Lord shall come up from the wilderness, and his spring shall become dry, and his fountain shall be dried up. He shall spoil the treasure of all pleasant vessels. He was fruitful among his brethren. How was Adam fruitful among his brethren? Who were the brethren of Adam? Why, I would suggest, dear friends, that Adam did certainly have brethren, because when he was in the Garden of Eden, sinless, he indeed was a brother with all those who were in harmony with God. And on the principle that all things equal to the same thing are equal to each other, we find that those who are in harmony with God are in harmony with one another. And therefore, Adam was brother, if you please, to all the myriad of creation of angels, seraphim, cherubims. He was all a part of this glorious divine family. And he was the only one that was fruitful amongst his brethren. Given to Adam as a human being was given the ability, the power of procreation. No angel had that ability or capacity. And so Adam was fruitful among his brethren. And while he had this unique ability, it says, an east wind shall come, the wind of the Lord shall come up from the wilderness. Oh, and how that east wind of sin did cause him to be expunged from the garden, to be expelled from the garden. And there, with a sword that turned in every direction, the angel of the Lord kept him from those trees in the garden. And therefore it says, and his spring shall become dry, his fountain shall be dried up, he shall spoil the treasure of all pleasant vessels. Oh, indeed, his spring is dry. His fountain is dried up, because as he is in this undone condition, the ability to procreate is taken from one in a matter of short years in the cycle of life, and then the dissolution into death follows. He shall spoil the treasure of all pleasant vessels. Oh, what that one sin accomplished, spoiling the treasure of all pleasant vessels. And so the east wind and the west wind, picturing sin and death and the glorious provision that God has in this ransom sacrifice. And then the north wind, blessings and tribulations which follow. Proverbs 25:23 is our reference there, which reads as follows. The north wind driveth away rain. And this thought of driving away rain is the thought of driving before rain. It brings forth rain. And it is this north wind which produces the clouds and the storms and the troublous and dark surrounding clouds that accompany great moisture and precipitation. And then, too, we read in Job 37:9 that cold cometh out of the north. And so the rain and the cold, as it were, the rain and the hail, the precipitated rain, which would be hail, comes from the north. And we see there, then, that the north does give the blessed truth, the facts of God's word, because the rain does picture truth. And the hail does picture the hard realities of that truth and the effect that that truth causes, as hail does hurl down upon the earth. And we find that the north winds are so devastating that Paul, you remember, in his journey to Rome, had experienced them for 2 weeks, and there was no sky, there was no sun, there was no stars, there was no heavens to be seen, but those winds just brought in its clutches all of the destinies of those who were aboard that vessel. And so the north wind is the wind of troubles and the wind of truth that the Lord is blowing upon the earth. And then there is the south wind, and that south wind is a picture to us in Job 37:9-17. It says, out of the south cometh the whirlwind. And then 17, how thy garments are warm when he quieteth the earth by a south wind. The whirlwind of trouble comes from the south, but yet it is accompanied by warmth and quietness. It is as though the south wind then brings with it an assurance and the means whereby the effects of the north wind can be ameliorated. And we note again that the garments are worn when he quieteth the earth by a south wind. And this south wind would then picture the taking off of garments when the earth is quieted. And if we were to take the time to go to the third chapter of Genesis, we would see how there God did fashion for man skins so that they might cover their nakedness. And how during this night time of sin and death, man has just been in his nakedness, in his sin. But the time would come, says Job, that the south wind would quiet the earth and garments would be warm. And what does one do when they are in warm garments? Why, they simply take off their clothing. And that is what will happen to the world of mankind when they are touched by the south wind, when the quietness of those winds will quiet the earth. Mankind will then be brought back to his pristine condition of sinlessness, where there'll be no more need to cover his nakedness. But rather than having learned the exceeding sinfulness of sin, they will then now be brought to a condition of righteousness and standing before God in relationship, now as a whole human family, as Adam stood alone before God in his original relationship to his God. And then, as Job then contemplates these winds, he then says, and now men see not the bright light which is in the clouds, but the wind passeth and cleanseth them. Fair weather cometh out of the north, with God is terrible majesty. In this 37th chapter, Job deals with the matter of clouds and with winds and how God is using them to manifest his purpose in the destiny of man. And then as these winds do their work, then he says, man sees not the bright light which is in the clouds. They only see the darkness, but behind every cloud there is this silver lining. The winds passeth and cleanses them, and fair weather comes out of the Lord from God. And then he says, with God is terrible majesty. That seems to be the essence, the culmination of it all. That out of all this phenomena of the winds and clouds comes the reality that God is terrible majesty. They see the power and the wisdom and the love and the justice of all God's dealings with them. And as they do so, they will revere him as a God of terrible, great, awesome majesty. But winds also is used in the scriptures in an undifferentiated sense, not merely in their directional purpose and function as we've just described, but also it is used in the sense of force or powers or dangers or temptations. This morning the reference to Ephesians 4 was made, and we were told that the purpose of the ecclesia and for its servants was that we henceforth be no more children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the sleight of man and cunning craftiness, whereby they lie in wait to deceive. And so here we see how winds pictures the forces of evil that might come upon us, and how the experiences of life may buffer us and beset us in different ways, and how these doctrinal tests and the sleight of men and deceptions, deceived and being deceived, going all about us, how we are not to allow them to affect us and our spiritual growth and development. And so we're in the world, we're not of the world, we're subject to all of the difficulties and trials and of this hour of temptation, but yet in the midst of them, our Father is able to keep us inviolate, keep us from falling. He has preserved us, he holds us in the palm of his hand so that nothing can pluck us out of his hands. And so as we think of these winds that come to try us in all facets and avenue of life, I often think of the winds that blow upon a lake. And as I look out upon the lake, I see there the outlines of little sails. And I see those little sailboats as they make their course around the lake. And I wonder how they are able to maneuver. How can the winds, as they are blowing in different directions, not keep those sailboats from going off course? But yet as I observe them, I see how as the winds blow stronger, and as the winds are more furious, it only impels those boats further on their journey with greater acceleration. And why is that? Because the skillful mariner is able to use those winds, is able to use those winds most constructively by a process which is known as jibing. And as they are jibing and tacking, as you see a mariner with a sail, and as the wind direction changes, he will immediately take down the sail, then switch the boom around and put the sail up again, and then the changing direction of the wind will just catch that sail in full balloon and thrust it forward on its course. And with the hand on the rudder, the new creature is able to take any experiences of life as they come. As those winds are changing and as they are calm or whether they be turbulent, is able to use them in the course that has been prescribed, that course which leads to the harbor of their rest. And so by the tacking and jiping of our spiritual lives, if we are actuated more by the Spirit of God, we're able then to take all of the experiences of life and every wind that might be about us, and particularly as we see the hurricanes and the forcefulness of this whirlwind experience the world is going through, we're able to use all of this to work together for good to those who love God and who are called according to His purpose. And so, dear friends, God did use this picture of winds, and it's a very beautiful picture, and we trust that with its rich imagery, we might understand His purpose better. May the Lord add His blessing. My discourse on winds. We have just a true brief announcement selection of hymn 106, after which we will stand and be dismissed with Brother Luke. 106, all verses.
I don't know.